for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Just days after suicide bombers attacked Moscow's subway system, the U.S. announced new security guidelines for air travelers entering the country. At the same time, the Obama administration released a troubling threat assessment of the nation's subways, highways, and rail systems. Joining me in the studio to talk about new efforts to keep travelers safe from terrorism, Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland, Thomas Frank of USA Today, and Frank Salufo of George Washington University. We do invite your calls, comments, questions. Join us by phone on 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
Michael Greenberger, explain these new travel guidelines issued by the Department of Homeland Security.
Well, these are all in response to the Christmas Day bombing incident where the Christmas Day bomber who was laced with explosives that he was trying to ignite on the landing on a flight, foreign flight into Detroit. The way the screening is done, there's a no-fly list, which people, if they're on it, when the airlines or security see the names, they can't fly. There's about 6,000 names on that list now. There's a secondary list of people who should be pulled out and carefully examined for various reasons. That's about 20,000 people. After the Christmas Day bombing, TSA, Transportation Security Agency, developed a third device, which was to screen every male coming out of 14 basically Muslim countries, Saudi Arabia, Algeria, Nigeria, Cuba, et cetera. It's just a across-the-board, no-discretion screening.
Cuba is hardly a Muslim country.
No, but most of the others are. And obviously, this was it was an emergency device, and the president at that point said, I want, within 90 days, a report about how we can do this better. And obviously, the mandatory screening is a very diplomatic issue, not only diplomatic, but it's a problem with Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, who were very upset about this kind of radical profiling.
Michael Greenberger, he's professor at the University of Maryland Law School, director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security. I want our listeners to know that we did invite a representative of the Transportation Security Administration to join us this morning. Thus far, they have declined. Turning to you now, Frank Salufo, how substantially different are these new rules from what we had before?
You know, they're not as substantially different as I think many people perceive them to be. When you look at aviation security, there are no silver bullets. There are no quick fixes. There are no easy solutions. What we're looking at is the need for a multi-layered defense that's underpinned by a good risk management methodology. So on the front end, you want to load that with good intelligence, good information, and then you want to make sure that you have the right technologies in place, as well as training the workforce to be able to be as accurate and as sufficient as they need to be on the back end. So it's a multi-layered approach. It does put emphasis on intelligence, which to me is the lifeblood for the campaign on terrorism, and hopefully will have the effect that will improve our capacity. So rather than trying to swat gnats with baseball bats, it's bringing a little bit of precision to our approaches. So time will tell as to how effective it will be, but I think it's a step in the right direction.
Frank Salufo, he is director of the Homeland Security Policy Institute at George Washington University. I am interested that the two of you are at different universities, each with the establishment How recently have Homeland Security departments, Frank?
Well, in our case, it's an institute. We like to think of ourselves as a think-and-do tank. So we're trying to bring theory and empirical research to policy. So we've been around since 2003, when I left the administration and stood this up at GW.
And you, Michael?
We're about to celebrate our 8th anniversary. We've grown substantially. We have 70 professionals on staff with advanced degrees. And our principal work is in the field with state and local first responder community, giving them advice on emergency planning. And we also have a major contract with the Federal Emergency Management Agency to train first responders around the country in certain kinds of emergency planning.
Turning to you now, Tom Frank of USA Today, you've been covering this subject for quite a while. How do these changes in rules affect what you and I and other travelers around the world are going to see coming into this country?
Point number one, this only affects people traveling to the U.S. from international destinations. If you're flying within the U.S., this makes no difference. I think that I would disagree a little with what Frank said. I think that this is significantly different from what had been in place up to Christmas Day. The focusing on people, giving them screening beyond the norm, what's called secondary screening, when you get pulled aside and they make you take off your shoes and they patch it down, they do all those things that nobody really likes. In the past, that has been driven largely by intelligence that attached a name to a person. So there's something called the selectee list, and then there's something called the no-fly list. Those are lists of actual people with names who either can't get on an airplane or who need to go through additional screening. What's different now is that foreign airlines or airlines operating in foreign countries will start pulling people aside for secondary screening based on characteristics, not their name. For example, intelligence might say there is a Nigerian man, say, who's between 20 and 30, who recently traveled to Yemen. That's all we know. We don't know his name. We don't have a passport number. But the intelligence says that there's a person who fits this description who is intent on blowing up a U.S.-bound airliner. So anyone who fits that description getting on an airplane bound for the U.S. overseas must be pulled aside for secondary screening. That's a real departure where the government and the foreign airlines are going to be using intelligence fragments that don't have a name.
And then the question becomes, I don't know if there are direct flights from Nigeria to this country, I assume not, but is the Nigerian government going to be doing its share of cooperating in that effort?
That's a very, very good question. I guess I would say two things. Going back before 9/11, the Nigerian government or the governments of any country with direct flights to the U.S. does cooperate. And if they don't cooperate, the U.S. government just says, well, you're not flying it to us. So the U.S. government, while it cannot control what happens in foreign airports, they can control what airplanes land in the U.S. As I understand it, and the administration has bounced back and forth on this, the foreign airlines in Lagos or in any city will be getting actual names of passengers. So their passenger manifest will have certain names highlighted who fit the description, as opposed to the foreign airlines getting the intelligence saying, we're looking for the people who fit this description.
Thomas Frank, he is Homeland Security reporter for USA Today. Join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I understand that Christmas Day attempted blowing up of an airline on its way to Detroit has prompted these changes. What I don't understand is how naming names is really going to make a huge difference. There are new terrorists springing up each and every day, and nobody has any idea what their names are, Michael.
Well, you know, I have a little bit of a different take on this. I think that, first of all, your question about what is Nigeria going to do is a very good one. After Christmas, we were screening every male of a certain characteristic coming out of Nigeria.
What is a certain characteristic?
Males between 20 and 45, for example.
About women?
Well, it could be women as well.
Yeah, if I can just jump in and correct. After December 25th, there were 14 countries, and anyone, male, female, young, old, flying either from those countries or who had a passport from one of those countries got secondary screening. So anyone with a Nigerian passport or who's traveled to the U.S., went through Nigeria, got secondary screening. They still could get on the plane, but they'd get that pat down, the body scan, the questioning.
And Diane, just one point here. The inefficiency of that or the concern of that, or the potential vulnerability of that, is you simply get someone with a passport from another country.
Exactly.
And that is clearly, there's a concern. It's referred to politically incorrect, but it's clean skins, those without known terrorist affiliation or criminal affiliation. And many of those are going to reside outside of those 14 targeted countries.
The important point, though, to get back to is this absolute screening from a country like Nigeria, Algeria, Saudi Arabia. If you're asking how are those countries going to help us, when you're having this absolute screening process of everyone, they obviously are not going to be very sympathetic that everyone has to be screened. And we've changed the system now to be more pinpointed based on intelligence.
Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland. Short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We're talking about new security efforts outlined by the administration to try to prevent the kind of situation which occurred on Christmas Day when a Nigerian who had received terrorist training in Yemen flew into the U.S., paid cash for his ticket, bought a one-way ticket, was not even stopped. How come? I mean, you know, this guy, with all the suspicious aspects to what he was doing, was not stopped. How come, Tom?
Okay, you mentioned cash ticket and one-way ticket. Let me just... There's been a lot said about that, and I think there's a lot of really misapprehension that if you buy a ticket that's one way or if you buy a ticket with cash that there's something suspect. And that may be true if you're in the U.S., but in a country like Nigeria, people have very little faith in the financial system. They're very reluctant to use credit cards because of fraud. So cash is the way a lot of tickets are bought. So buying a cash ticket overseas is not significant. Buying a one-way ticket also, I'm not so sure he did buy a one-way ticket, by the way, but it's also not all that significant. Why wasn't he caught? His name was not in any intelligence database is why.
Well,
can I push back on that?
Yeah.
Sure.
Because his name was, in fact, on a database. His name was in the Tide database, which is a huge database comprising fragments of derogatory information. The point is our airports and airplanes should be our last lines of defense. You had his own father turning to the embassy, providing information that he was concerned that his son was being radicalized in Yemen. He should have never been issued a visa in the first place. There was enough data to be able to curtail that. He was not issued one in the UK, not necessarily because they were concerned about hostile activity, but because he lied in his visa form. So to me, this is the data was there, but it was in this massive vacuum cleaner called Tide, which ultimately has to be refined all the way through selectee lists to no-fly lists.
And I think it's important to add that President Obama asked that the study be conducted in the immediate wake of it, and the conclusion was that they should have stopped this man, that he could have and should have been stopped. And in fact, this entire new regime we're talking about, which is not taking everyone from certain countries but using intelligence, is based on an attempt to further our discovery of terrorists. But in fact, the system that was in place at that time, if it were working correctly, should have stopped this man.
So, Tom, when you asked administration officials when all this would begin, what kind of an answer did you get?
Well, after about the fourth time I asked, I got them to agree that we could say this month. I did point out in the briefing last Thursday that it was only April 1st. So if they said this month, that gives them until April 30th. So the answer is that it is going to be phased in. I don't know if there's going to be a date suddenly when things are going to snap and turn on. But they're in the process of rolling it out.
And, Michael, do you believe we'll get what? 90% cooperation from other countries, 100%? What's your belief?
I think, well, I can't put a number on it, but I think we're going to get a lot more cooperation than had been the case before Christmas Day.
Really?
And that people think, well, yes. And in fact, when Janet Napolitano was on your show several weeks ago, she mentioned that they made a concerted effort to go to make a worldwide trip, in effect, to go to airports to ensure that we're depending on foreign airlines, foreign security to basically do this screening for us. And I myself in my foreign travels have found that these countries have been extremely diligent after the Christmas Day bombing. And I think Secretary Napolitano and Secretary of State Clinton feel some assurance that we will get cooperation. I will tell you, we'll get a lot more cooperation now in Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, Algeria, by saying we're not going to screen every one of your people just based on their citizenship, but we're going to use intelligence and pinpoint this. And I might finally add that this is very much the way the Israeli system operates. Now, they've got a lot easier job because it's going in and out of Tel Aviv, one airport, 50,000 people. We've got our whole country, 2 million people. But if this is done correctly, it will be a much more effective system, not only to stop terrorists, but not to aggravate the people we depend on abroad to stop terrorists.
How does this system, this approach, differ from profiling?
You know, I mean, profiling's become a dirty word. The reality is this is profiling, but it's based on behavioral indicators and underpinned by good intelligence and information. So I've long been an advocate of these sorts of efforts, which don't profile simply based on demographic, race, or religion, but based on intelligence. So here I think you are looking at the dirty word profiling, but it's done in a way that I think actually enhances transparency. Just one word of caution, though, and obviously people do look at the Israeli model, but we have more planes flying out every 10 minutes, I think, than they have in a day. So you've got a scale and scope issue. And with our foreign nations, you've got a capacity issue. We've got to build up the capacity of their authorities to be able to deal with this information. And that is something that is wanting, not out of lack of desire, but lack of capability.
And Tom, these new rules deal primarily or exclusively with planes coming into the United States. Are there any new rules affecting domestic flights?
If by new you mean within the last week, no. If by new you mean post 9/11, there are one or two. If you mean post Christmas Day, there aren't new rules, but there have been some new procedures put in place.
Such as? And
the main one is that the TSA agents are now using explosive detection, what they call swabs. You may have seen them, the little machines where they rub a cotton swab on your bag and put it in a machine to see if there's any explosive traces picked up. Those machines are being basically carted around the airport. They take them to the concourses, to the gates where you're sitting. So a TSA screener may come up to you while you're sitting there reading USA Today, waiting to get on your airplane. They may say, "Can I see your hands?" And they may rub one of these little swabs over your hand to see if there's any explosive residue on your hand, or they may rub it over your backpack or your purse. That's the only major new procedure. And they're also in the process of installing a lot of body scanners, these machines that take electronic images underneath your clothing.
Now, how many of those are now in place in airports in this country? Do we know?
It's almost 50. Uh-huh. There were about 40 before Christmas Day, and there have been installations in, I think, two airports, being Chicago O'Hare and Boston Logan. There are plans to install an additional 150 in coming months. And then eventually, if the budget that the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, proposed for fiscal 11, there will be 1,000 of these in U.S. airports, which means basically there will be one in pretty much every airport.
One other point. It's my understanding that we do not yet have a head of the Transportation Security Agency, the DEA, the AFT, or even Customs and Border Patrol. Why have these critical posts been left unfilled?
Actually, Customs and Border Patrol, the president did make a recess appointment.
Okay.
But he couldn't recess TSA because he doesn't have a nominee. There have been two nominees. Both have withdrawn. One was claimed to have, former FBI agent was claimed to have improperly accessed databases to find out about his wife's former wife's girlfriend. Another had contractual problems of some kind, Major Harding, who just withdrew. Frankly, I think this is really a disgrace. I mean, we can talk about all these new rules and scanning machines that are going to place, but what institution do you know that you have any faith in that doesn't have a CEO that's driving the institution? I think the president is to blame, because even with the appointments he's made, there were delays in making the appointments. The Congress is very much to blame for this. There are 217 nominees that the president has sent up who haven't been confirmed, 77 who have gone all through the whole process. At this point in time, President Bush had 5 who had gone through the whole process and not been confirmed. But my personal view about this is that the president is a great believer in bipartisanship. He should get the leaders of the various committees, chairs and ranking members, Republicans and Democrats, into the White House and get this problem fixed in a matter of weeks. We now have to wait for a new nominee, and then if it's business as usual, it will be months.
Frank. To pick up on this point, to give you an example, there are still 88 committees or subcommittees that have some semblance of oversight on the Department of Homeland Security. Alan Burson, who was tapped as and nominated as commissioner for CBP, Customs and Border Patrol, the committee responsible for his oversight was Senate Finance, the same committee that was in charge of health care. So you can imagine that issue is going to be a footnote in their prioritization. The administrator for DEA, given all the challenges we're having on the border and the expansion of the Mexican drug cartels, was only nominated in late January, a year after the president was in power. ATF we still don't have a nominee. Mm. So I agree with Michael. This is you've got executive branch and legislative branch fingerprints to blame here. But I think that you've got a broader set of issues, and that's how do you do effective oversight on these issues? It's been dysfunctional at best.
So with some of these departments, the president, the administration has some people in mind, at least. Do you expect any recess appointments, Tom?
Not for TSA. I just the most recent nominee just withdrew a week and a half ago, so I don't think there's going to be a recess.
No backup there.
Well, since they've gone through two appointments or two nominations, I'm sure they have a long list of people they're thinking about.
Look out, Tom, you're going to be appointed next.
But I don't think that they did a fairly fast job of getting the second nominee's name out after the first one withdrew. It took about 2 months. It took them a very long time. President Obama did not nominate the first TSA administrator until September. And then that got bogged down in hearings and some questions about his background.
Tom Frank, he's Homeland Security reporter for USA Today. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. So far, we've been talking about air travel. What about the subway system? What about trains? What about buses? Who's worrying about those? Frank?
You know, Diane, that's a good set of questions. And given the most recent tragic incident in Moscow,
of course,
this is something we ought to be paying much greater attention to. And recently there was a surface transportation assessment done, which is a step in the right direction. But to me, long on nouns, short on verbs. We really need to start moving toward effective programs, which are going to be much broader in terms of both scale and scope, and it can't be the same approach we have with aviation security. Here, I think the secret, if there is one, is inserting uncertainty into our countermeasures. It's enhanced random searches. It's improved use of canines.
On subways?
At the subway stations. And again, in terms of scale and scope, this is going to be huge. But if we put magnetometers or other technologies in place, which are so laborious, why take the subway? You're going to take a car, which is already too difficult in terms of gridlock. So we've got to look at this a little differently, but the writing, unfortunately, is on the wall. If you look at global statistics, transportation targets have been primary targets of terrorist activity. 311 in Spain, 77 in the UK, obviously Moscow, which is eerily similar to what they faced in 2004, where you had women homicide bombers take very similar actions. So how do we scale and scope this sort of effort in the United States? And heretofore, we've spent cents on the dollar in terms of aviation. And they're not mutually exclusive. We can and must have both. But I think more has to occur in this space.
Tom.
Well, I'd also add that there have been threats against the New York subway system, including the one most recently of Najibullah Zazi, who was plotting to set off bombs. So the New York subway system, the United States has been warned that there is interest. The model for security in subways is vastly different than for aviation. In the aviation model, it is the security of the aviation system is the responsibility of the federal government. That's written in law. The security of local mass transit systems is not the responsibility of the federal government.
Well, of course, the states don't have enough money to put into place the kinds of security systems that need to be there.
Well, it's, if they wanted to have the money, they could have the money. It's a matter of priorities. It's also a question of this balance that is this constant theme of Homeland Security, of convenience versus security. Mm. Are you going to make people go through metal detectors to get on the
Maybe.
New York subway system?
Maybe.
Well, I think that there's an acknowledgement that that would basically turn the New York subway system. It would make it, you couldn't make it operate. I think one other point that needs to be made about the subway systems is that, first of all, there are only about a dozen in this country. For those of us who live in D.C., we depend on it. For those of us who live in New York, but the vast number of people don't go on a subway system.
They go on buses.
They
drive.
They drive to work.
Well,
that's the way this country is.
That's true, too.
For a lot of people, the issue with a terrorist attack on the New York subway system is that it would be awful and it would be tragic, but it would not terrorize people in Iowa, frankly, because, first of all, people in Iowa are already terrified of the New York subway system, which is unfortunate because it's a good subway system and it's a safe subway system. But attacking a subway system is really an attack on a subway system. Attacking the aviation system is an attack on the United States, and I think that's a fundamental difference. In Moscow last week, after the bombings of the subway system, the subways were running later that day. Those people aren't terrified if they're going to get on the subway at the exact stop where the bombing occurred.
Are the two different, Michael?
Well, they are different, and I agree with that. And you get more bang for your buck if you terrorize an airline than if you do it at a subway. But first of all, I want to say I'm going to a meeting with Governor O'Malley when I leave here today. The states are, and the cities, even more than the states, are so fundamentally stretched for money. They're running major deficits. We only have to look at our own metro. Our metro is more dangerous without terrorists than it is with terrorists because of a lack of funding.
Michael Greenberger, he's professor at the University of Maryland Law School. Short break. When we come back, your calls.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, whose Germany.info publishes news and politics, culture and lifestyle at Germany.info, by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org, and by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
Having a child to save a sibling, the ethical, emotional, and scientific issues involved with having a baby with a genetic match to another with a rare disease. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. It's time to open the phones. Your questions for our three guests, Tom Frank of USA Today, Frank Salufo of George Washington University, and Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland. Let's go first to Hector in Orlando, Florida. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
My question is, what about domestic radicalists or militant groups? Would they too be watched as far as airlines are concerned or other forms of public transportation? Thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling. Frank.
Well, yes, we do have to be concerned about domestic radicalization in the United States. The 2009-2010 showed a metastasization of the threat. Zazi, who had plotted to engage in synchronized and simultaneous attacks on the New York subway, is connected to Al-Qaeda Central. He had connections to Pakistan, and that was more of what we've historically been looking at. If you look at the Christmas bomber and Abdul Muttalib, he was connected to an Al-Qaeda affiliate, Lashkar-e-Taribia. and there are a number of other cases. To Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and David Headley was connected to LET. Then we have a whole vast of those that are inspired by Al Qaeda's ideology, but not affiliated with any terrorist organization directly. That includes Jihad Jane. That includes the five guys who traveled to Pakistan from Virginia. So it's a broad set of threats that comes in different shapes, different sizes, and different flavors. So unfortunately, there's no single profile wherein you can look at where one turns. Where does one turn from sharing the ideals to actually acting upon those ideals? So that makes it difficult for law enforcement.
To Durham, North Carolina. Good morning, Susie. You're on the air. Susie, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
I love your show. You're great.
Thanks.
You're wonderful. Thank you for taking my call. I'm just calling because I was in a situation where I went to the airport and I parked my car by the place where you drop your luggage, and I ended up going in there because I had a problem with my ticket. And then when I came back out, I got a ticket by the security officer. And then I went and parked my car, and so I ran into the get on my flight, and I missed my flight because of the ticket that I got. And then so I was trying to get my ticket changed, my flight ticket changed. And then I got upset because they wouldn't change my ticket. And then because they wouldn't change my ticket, then I was labeled as someone who was a possible threat, which...
How do you know that? How do you know that, Susie? How do you know?
Because every time I fly after that date, they do all these extreme security checks that I never had done before.
Interesting. Tom, does that ring true?
I don't know if it does or it doesn't. Certainly, don't park your car where you're not supposed to outside
yeah,
of an airport terminal.
For sure.
Those are considered very, vulnerable areas. There is a program that you can go to the TSA.gov. There is a program if you think you're incorrectly being pulled aside for extra screening. There is a redress program. Go to the TSA website, follow the procedures.
That's a great idea, Susie, and I hope you'll follow on that because I'm sure it's an inconvenience for you. Let's go now to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Scott. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I just have a comment followed by a question, and the comment is it seems that these terrorist operations have all been precipitated by discontent in the Middle East with American foreign policy in that area. And it also seems to me that the Obama administration seems to be trying to address some of those concerns that seem to be popping up in the mouths of terrorists or would-be terrorists. And my question is, do these gentlemen feel that if we were to succeed in some of our initiatives in the Middle East, trying to bring more equality and justice in that area, like particularly in Palestine and Israel, do they think that this may have a reducing effect on these type of terrorist efforts?
Michael.
Well, I think the short answer is yes, but it is never going to be complete. The president made this famous speech in Egypt, I believe, where he did try and reach out to the Muslim world, and I think that has had an effect. But the terrorism we're experiencing has a base of irrationality that goes beyond our foreign policy or a diplomatic thing of just instinctive hate for the United States and its way of life or the Western world. And point number two is something that's been mentioned earlier, and I had personal experience when I was in the Justice Department, is we've got these domestic problems with domestic terrorists. These Guardian of the Free Republic wrote letters to our governors, 33 governors, threatening nuanced way if they didn't resign in 3 days. The man who flew his plane into the IRS building, Jihad Jane, Timothy McVeigh. These are problems that are all over the place, and they've come on very hard. They've come on very hard now, and we've just got to, I think it's important to have an effective diplomatic effort, but we've got to have both an offensive and defensive effort to deal with these issues.
If I could just build on that a little bit, because I think the question the caller had was a good one. And obviously actions speak louder than words, but I think one of the things we need to be looking at in terms of counterterrorism is the narrative. Why is the message, Al-Qaeda's narrative, sticking and resonating with folks? And we need to be able to push back on that. Ultimately, we need to be able to show their nouns, what they say, their verbs, what they do. And if you look at Al-Qaeda's narrative, which is a so-called war against Islam and clash of civilizations, why is it that the vast majority of Al-Qaeda's victims are Muslim? Why don't we know the stories, the faces, the names of Al-Qaeda's victims here? What dreams did they have? What dreams were lost? So I think that we need to tread here carefully, but much of our counterterrorism policy has been tactical in nature. We do need to get strategic, and we need to address the ideology and help facilitate it falling under its own weight.
All right, to Indianapolis. Good morning, Matt. You've had an interesting experience.
I did indeed. I was one of the people who was swabbed at an airport, and the gentleman took the swab. He put it was a sort of a cloth disc. Then he put it into a machine to see if there was any explosive residue. And what happened is the machine lit up, and it said explosives detected. And I'm trying to wonder what I'm going to look like in an orange jumpsuit at that point, and what I'd look like on the evening news. He stares at the machine for a minute, and then he says, this thing isn't working. He snaps up my bag, hands it to me, goes, here you go, sir, have a nice flight. And I didn't know which was worse, the concept that I had had a false positive test on an explosive or the fact that it had said I had explosives, and he gave me my bag back and said, go ahead and get on your plane.
Well, we've got a number of issues here, Tom.
Okay, one of the downsides of the experience, that I guess there are two, but it's true, there are a lot of false positives because a lot of items can cause you to seem like you have explosive. For example, heart pills, they have nitroglycerin
on them. Exactly.
Nitroglycerin is an explosive. So if you've just taken a heart pill and someone swabs your hand, you're going to be seen as having some kind of explosive residue.
Matt, did you by any chance had you taken nitroglycerin?
No, I had not.
Okay.
He just swabbed the outside of my bag. The zipper of the bag.
Yeah, okay.
If I could just, you know, one of the problems here is we are depending on scanners, we're depending on these machines, we're depending on our intelligence. The intelligence has to be good. The technology has to work.
Why didn't the screener open his suitcase even if the screener thought it was a false positive?
He should have gotten an X.
Of course he should.
Ideally, that should be standard operation.
But,
you know, all these body scanners are coming online, and now there's science and technological guidance worried about whether these body scanners would pick up the very kind of technology that the Christmas Day bomber used. I think there has been far too little careful examination of the technology we're using. I think a lot of it isn't going to work well. I think it's been oversold. And I think that is a further problem the administration and DHS have, is to make sure they've got technology that works.
Tom,
when you say technology, you can think of it in two ways. It can apprehend, and it's not perfect, but it also can deter. And even if technology doesn't work, it can have a deterrent effect. So even if you put these body scanners up there and they're not even plugged in, they don't do anything, they will have some effect because they will they can be a deterrent. And a lot of people talk about, oh, it's all security theater. Fine, but security theater can have a deterrent effect.
What part do ordinary traveling citizens play in this security theater? What assistance can someone like me be?
Michael? Oh, I think a lot of people who worry about these things place a very high premium on an alert public that's watching out for things like a car that's empty and parked in front of the airport, like bags that are just lying around or someone that you believe is suspicious. I think we have a natural instinct not to rely on our suspicions. And I think an effort is being made for people to be overly cautious. And you hear when you're in the airport, if you see something suspicious, tell somebody. I always use the famous example of the snipers back in 2002. The task force debated about putting out the description of the car and the license plate. They finally put it out. In 45 minutes, a trucker spotted the car.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
Yeah. The other thing I would say
is, on the other hand, we don't want to accuse people just because of our own personal instincts.
Well, that raises two points. One, I think in this instance, we have to be a little more aggressive. The second thing I do want to mention before we leave is the profiling aspect. It was said that the use of this intelligence is, well, let's face it, it's profiling. I think it's a step back from profiling. Profiling is when you say everybody from certain countries is going to be screened no matter what. Profiling is when the New Jersey State Police picked up randomly people who were African-American driving on the New Jersey Turnpike. Here, we hope there will be more pinpointed information, not that just somebody is Muslim or of person of color, but we have more information. And I think it's a step away from profiling.
Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to Carrie, who's here in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Carrie. You're on the air.
Good morning. My mother was killed on September 11th, and I want to say that I think all Americans need to be part of not only aviation security, but also all transportation security. And I get very disappointed when I hear people waiting in line at the airport who complain about the security we're going through. I wish that more people would thank the airport screeners. And I also want to salute Frank's comments about talking more about the victims of Al-Qaeda. I've been working with victims around the globe, and their voices and their stories are some of the strongest tools we can use to help prevent future attacks.
Carrie, I'm so glad you called, and I'm so sorry for your loss. That must have been just horrible for you. So continuing to work with victims, continuing to work with people who want to ramp up and secure the security, I think is really sort of your courageous output. And I thank you for your work.
If I could second Carrie Lamack, and I believe that's you, Carrie.
Hi, Frank. Yes.
You are, your efforts, I think, are some of the most important and significant that we have going on here. And it highlights the fact that this is not just the government set of responsibilities, but a whole of society approach. So I salute your efforts, and I suggest to all the listeners to follow up, go on the internet, and read some of Carrie's good work.
Carrie, thanks for calling. What about travelers coming in from Mexico and Canada? What are we doing? You're shaking your head, Michael.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, the Canadian border has its problems. We in the millennium, we caught the Millennium Bomber coming across the Canadian border into the United States. But the Southwest border is a travesty. You know, the so-called fence is not really, it sounds great, but it's not really working. It's porous. There's a cause célèbre right now because an Arizona rancher was killed by someone coming across the border and going back over the border. The drug problems, the drug gangs are pretty much, the border is becoming porous. This is a real problem. It requires the highest degree of focus. And that's why, incidentally, the fact that the president made the recess appointment of a quite talented man who was held up for months in his confirmation and is now taking charge of the Customs and Border Patrol thing is so important. There was an article in the New York Times recently that they don't have enough polygraph examiners to examine the people they're trying to hire for Border Patrol. There are corruption problems there. It really just requires the greatest of attention. And, you know, if we have a terrorist problem, I think the porous border in the Southwest is going to be pinpointed as a as a real entryway for problems.
Well, and let's not exclude Canada either. As you perhaps have someone coming in from Saudi Arabia going to Canada and then coming in through that border, I mean, there is no way to be perfectly safe.
Well,
and I think we have to acknowledge
that. Yeah, the Canadian border has been a problem. There's the famous episode in June of 2007 where somebody who had tuberculosis and was, they were trying to keep him out of the country, came in through Canada talking a border patrol guard that even though his name was on a list to be picked up, he wasn't picked up. But the problems on the southwest border are just exponentially greater.
Well, that's the end of our conversation, left with lots of questions, lots of conversation yet to be had as we see the direction in which the administration goes. Thank you all so much, Michael Greenberger, Tom Frank, Frank Salufo. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.